Hello, and welcome to Illinois Realtors Weekly Podcast, keeping up to date with all the latest news in realtor world. I'm Matt Silver, your 2024 Illinois Realtor President, and I'm happy to be taking charge of the podcast for the month of April. I'm especially excited to be kicking off Fair Housing Month with a conversation with NAR's Vice President of Political Advocacy, Mr. Brian Green. Brian has been overseeing fair housing policy and enforcement for more than decades. He's going to give us a great interview and great overview of the state of fair housing at the national level. Brian, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us and being the man that you are. You're absolutely incredible. I will say that I am your biggest fan. How's that?
Oh, thank you, man. Oh, that's really kind. That's a great way to start off April and Fair Housing Month. It's great to be here.
Let's just dive right in if we can. And I'm going to give you sort of an easy question right off the bat. If you would, please discuss your role for the last 29 years. Yes, I said 29 years at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. You were the top career official overseeing enforcement of the Federal Fair Housing Act. Can you tell us about that and some of those experiences that you had there?
Sure. So long before I was the top official, I was the lowest official. I started my career at HUD as an investigator in the Boston regional office, where I went around the six New England states investigating fair housing cases. And then I spent the last decade of my career overseeing HUD's roughly 600 person office at that time, and all of our investigations throughout the country, as well as all of our grant programs and the state and local partnerships that we had. So, so it really means there's really nothing new under the sun that I haven't seen when it comes to housing discrimination issues, variations on a theme.
You know, fair housing is a key component of our advocacy commitment too. And I guess really to sort of dive a little bit deeper into the discussion, can you give us a little bit of the history behind Fair Housing Month, why it came about, sort of what was the impetus for it?
Yeah. So, we celebrate Fair Housing Month in April because the Fair Housing Act was passed April 11th, 1968. And so almost immediately, HUD and its partners began to commemorate the passage of the law, in part to educate people on the law and what it requires. So that's going back now 56 years. There have been these opportunities to educate, commemorate. This particular year, we're also celebrating the 50th anniversary of the amendments to the act to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex/gender. So that was added to the act in 1974. That same year, Congress also passed the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which prohibited discrimination on the basis of gender in credit transactions. And that law was later amended to add race and color as well. As well as other bases. So this year is a milestone year for those additional protections. It's also the 60th anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the very first major civil rights law, which had some prohibitions for housing and discrimination in public housing, but it really wasn't until the 1968 Fair Housing Act that the entire market was covered by fair housing protections.
What are some of the things that have been done by the industry over the years to achieve equity and most importantly, equity? And how can we achieve equality in housing? You know, the everyday practitioner, you know, they don't always want to take a leadership role, or they don't always want to be the one to step forward, but they do want to participate. And I think that those folks are just as important in the equation here. So how do we, I guess it's a two-part question. How do we get them involved? And then what can we do to sort of, help them play a larger role, you know, up to their discretion, of course, you know, to sort of, I guess, end what's been going on, but be great stewards of, you know, what we're trying to achieve here with fair housing.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a lot of it is awareness, and a lot of it is going into situations eyes wide open. So, you know, you can't really be effective in achieving fair housing if your attitude is see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, right? So you've got to be aware of both, not just the law and what it requires, but just what the larger ramifications are and where we've been. And so I think having some perspective on your own community and where there has been past discrimination and, you know, the effect that has had. So to be conscious of that and why we need the fair housing laws and why we need, you know, as professionals to be conscious that we're treating people fairly. I think that's critically important. You know, our fair housing trainings that we provide at the National Association of Realtors try to do both. They try to give people some historical context. And so, for example, if you take Fairhaven, the interactive training that the National Association of Realtors created, in addition to creating scenarios where you have to judge what is, you know, fair treatment, there are case stories built into that. There's some history that's built into that. So you can understand where we're coming from, that, you know, these issues are animated by a history. So I think that's critically important. I think in small ways, people can get engaged in their communities too. So just in Illinois, you know, different communities have been looking at their history, like Evanston, for example, you know, looked at the role that the city played and, you know, how it created the housing patterns that you see today. And it took some proactive steps to try to address that. And so to be conscious, you know, read just to understand is key. And then, you know, the Illinois realtors and the proactive steps it's taken to address historical appraisal discrimination, I think is really important. And so even if you're not going to engage directly in some of that, to read what's going on and to understand the context in which you are selling real estate, I think is critically important. And that will make you, I think, treat people more fairly and understand why it's really important that you do that. So books like Color of Law, I think, by Richard Rothstein, a good friend of mine, really opened up the eyes for a lot of people. It's amazing that people, you know, for a lot of people, their historical knowledge goes back, you know, just a couple of decades. And even then, we have a way of coloring the past, you know, or sanitizing the past and not fully appreciating.
By the way you put it, I totally agree with you.
Yeah, what actually happened. I mean, so for example, you know, and we've had to, as the National Association of Realtors, confront this, you know, we actually, as an association, opposed the passage of the 1968 Fair Housing Act. I've been to conferences where people suggested otherwise, but it's clear we opposed it. And, you know, there's a whole archive of all of the, you know, legislative advocacy that we took to try to kill the passage of the Fair Housing Act, not to mention, you know, the deeper history of our association with, a code of ethics that actually insisted that real estate professionals discriminate. And so acknowledging that and acknowledging that we could be so bold in those days to have promoted discrimination is to understand that culture, that mindset doesn't just go away. And, you know, we also did not allow people of color in our membership ranks. And so you had other associations like NAREB form because they could not be members of the National Association of Realtors. So a lot of the, you know, that history and a lot of that change, you know, really didn't begin to take strong hold until just a few decades ago. And so it is a continuum, you know, and we're continually getting better. We all know that just 4.5 years ago, there was that New York Newsday expose, which showed real estate agents engaging in pretty nasty discrimination out in Long Island. So, you know, this stuff still happens. But I think in the last 5 years, 4.5 to 5 years, we've also made leaps forward. We created a Fair Housing Committee, a first Fair Housing Committee exclusively devoted to fair housing policy. We created that in 2019. And just in the last few years, we've done training programs and engaged in other accountability measures, self-testing that real estate agents are signing up to do to test their companies to make sure they're not discriminating. All of these efforts, I think, demonstrate we're a new National Association of Realtors. But there's just a lot of work to do still. And we've got to recognize that, you know, the past doesn't just disappear. There are lingering effects from these past actions. And so that's why we have to be really conscious and understanding that, you know, in order to move forward, you know, we've got to take into account the harm that was done.
I'm known for saying that we're in a movement and not a moment. And, you know, when you think about how these things have perpetuated themselves for 300, 400, 500 years, when we talk about making progress, quote unquote, over the last 3 to 5 years, you could see that there's a huge discrepancy. And to your point, I think that there are a lot of, unfortunately, there's still a lot of vestiges of things that linger from our past. And one of the, you just brought up The Color of Law, written by Richard. And I thought it was probably one of the most educational and enlightening books that I've ever read. And then coupled with Isabel Wilkerson's two phenomenal books that she read, I would love to see those two get together and just put it all on paper, because I think it would be such an incredible blend of, you know, this is, you know, the legal side. And then the way Isabel just kind of attacks it in such a delicate and beautiful manner with her prose, to just really make everybody, especially people who look like me, really understand that just because this happened way back then doesn't mean that we are no longer, you know, responsible. Yeah. Right.
Right. I love or that the harm caused just goes away. And so just as, you know, we talk about intergenerational wealth, you know, having it and passing it on is advantageous, right? And absolutely. If you didn't have it and you fall behind, you know, that disadvantage is compounded as well. And so we have to appreciate that. And so now we're trying to make sure everyone's rowing in the same direction, but, you know, folks who were behind don't suddenly catch up. And so there's a lot to do. And, you know, I think just being conscious of it helps us identify solutions when they present themselves. And so now, you know, there's a lot of efforts to make sure that we have down payment assistance, that we, we take a closer look at credit scoring and make sure it's not inadvertently leaving people behind, all these things.
And
the alternative credit scores. I mean, essentially what it's recognizing is that more people are credit worthy than we've acknowledged, in part because credit scoring just didn't take into account in many respects people's most significant outlays of money, right?
And like, let's be honest, I think those credit scoring techniques were rigged as well. So I'm just going to call them out for what I see, correct?
So, you know, they were limited for all number of reasons, not to mention if you go back, you know, a few generations ago, just someone's good word at the bank helped you. Right.
Right.
And so, you know, would have been nice to get in on the ground floor of that. Right. Because that, you know, what, let's say if that was our grandparents' generation, if you got that benefit and then you got a house and then you had the equity in the house, you know, you didn't have to deal with, you know, this kind of credit, this precise credit scoring that we do today that could approve or disapprove you. And so, but that being said, you know, there are ways for us to try to make, you know, greater progress. I mean, there's the special purpose credit programs that are looking at, you know, where credit has been denied in the past and, you know, if programs can be designed to try to address some of that. So people are recognizing the need to do more. And then everyone is facing serious disadvantages today in a market where there's such limited housing opportunity. The majority of Americans can't afford the median priced home. And right. So, we really do need to build more housing. And I think there's a general recognition that if you increase the supply, housing becomes more affordable for a wider array of people. But that also means that we have to make the land use and zoning decisions to build that housing. And, you know, that also in the past has been a culprit for segregation and discrimination, to sort of limit where housing can be built so that that housing would be beyond the means of many people. And so I think we're all sort of beginning to recognize that we need more housing. If we have more housing, it will be more affordable. And if we build that housing throughout the country, it's going to create more housing opportunity for people of all backgrounds. And that is going to create more diverse communities. And we just have to embrace that as a country.
Yeah. And a rising tide lifts all boats, right? People are not going to lose their station. Life will improve for everybody. No. So,
yeah. Yes.
You know, you brought up Evanston, and I'm wondering, a little off topic, if that's okay. How many other communities around the United States have done what Evanston is trying to do? I was aware of a community in California. I can't remember if indeed they have actually moved forward with what Evanston is doing. And would you, if you can, just give a quick background on what Evanston has tried to do and how it's working, if you have any insider info on that?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, what Evanston did was they actually looked at their history and acknowledged that they restricted where African-Americans could live, right? And so, you know, whether you want to call it redlining or, but just, you know, put simply, Blacks could live only in a certain section of Evanston. And, you know, after the passage of the Fair Housing Act, things began to change. And so they decided to create a fund that would provide housing assistance to people who could demonstrate that they were harmed by those past practices. As far as whether other communities have done this, you're right that I've heard of others that were contemplating it. Likewise, a community in California. I know the state of Washington passed a transfer tax that would create funding to provide some pool of money for Washington state residents who had been harmed by past redlining as well. So I don't know the details of just how they're actually going to operate that. But that was just this past year, and my understanding that passed with the support of the Washington State Realtors Association. So, I know many people have looked to Evanston as a model, but I don't know of others who have you know, reach the end of the line and actually enacting something.
Hmm. I know my great friend Frank Williams here in Chicago always discusses the significant loss of generational wealth. And, you know, I've heard numbers that are anywhere between 400 million and, you know, 400 billion, to be very honest with you. And I never really know what that number is, but I can speak and say very confidently, unfortunately, that it is incredibly significant. And, you know,
and you know, it's the wealth that a lot of people overlook when they look at income. So just using the example again of African-Americans and whites, I think the typical African-American has maybe 80% of the income of the typical white American, but about 10% of the wealth.
Yes, that's correct. So, because I know I spoke with Dr. Courtney Johnson Rose about a month ago, and I believe she said that the average wealth of a Black American was about $25,000 for a property owner, and the average net worth, I guess maybe is a better way to put it, for a white American was around $250,000. So it's drastic and it's significant. Right.
And that's where you see, you know, the generational effect. And so you can be working someplace and looking at your colleagues and thinking, well, you know, they seem to do just as well as I do. They've got this, you know, job, but that's overlooking, you know, the generations that came before and what that individual has to do to achieve that. And that's why you see the student loan debt, right? The disproportionate student loan debt among people of color, because you need education to get ahead. But if you didn't have housing equity to help pay, say, for school in the past, you're taking on the debt in the current generation to achieve that.
Yeah, without question. I know Jamie Tan, who's the national president for ARIA, discusses her story about how her parents, you know, emigrated here. And, you know, had they not been able to purchase a home, she would not have been able to live the life and to get to the colleges and universities and to have the great success that she's had. It's a very telling and incredible story as well. So, I will leave everybody with this. I think what you said was to educate and to commemorate and to facilitate the end of discrimination would be just such an incredible achievement. And I just want to thank you and the listeners for joining us on the latest episode of the podcast. And as always, give us a rating and a review on your podcast app of choice. And if you want more content, simply search for Illinois Realtors on your favorite social media app. And we'll see you next week. Brian, you're an amazing man, and I am proud to call you my friend. And thanks for everything that you do at the national level to help folks like us bring forth fair housing.
Thanks, Matt. It was a pleasure to join you today.
You're incredible.